The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We'll start today's program with an article titled "The Feminist Behind the Man Behind the Curtain" by Evan I. Schwartz. The Untold Story of Matilda Gage, the free thinker who inspired her son-in-law, L. Frank Baum's classic novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Every living generation has been petrified by The Wizard of Oz. Early in the 1939 film, a cranky neighbor riding her bicycle through a tornado suddenly transforms into a witch. She soars off in her broomstick, tilting her head back and screaming with laughter as her cloak billows out behind her. The 1900 book by L. Frank Baum, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, inspired the film's theme of good and evil sorcery. All the witches in the story have magical powers. They can fly, materialize at will, and see all things far and near. But while the witches of the North and South are kind and supportive, the witches of the East and West are seen as evil. Remember that the witch is wicked, tremendously wicked, and ought to be killed. The Great Oz bellows at Dorothy as she heads off to the West. The backstories of the Wicked Witch of the West and Glinda the Good are the subject of the newly released movie Wicked, based on Gregory Maguire's 1995 novel and Winnie Holzman and Stephen Schwartz's 2003 stage musical. The witch, who is unnamed in The Wizard of Oz, has a name in Wicked, Elphaba, an homage to the initials of L. Frank Baum. His first name, which he rarely used, was Lyman. But the real-life backstory of The Witches of Oz is just as fascinating. It involves a hidden hero of the 19th century women's rights movement and the most powerful woman in Baum's life, his mother-in-law, Matilda Electa Joslyn Gage. It was likely at Gage's urging that Baum began submitting his poems and stories to magazines. Gage even suggested putting a cyclone in a children's story. But she was a notable figure in her own right. As one of the three principal leaders of the women's rights movement, along with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Gage was known for her radical views and confrontational approach. At the Statue of Liberty's unveiling in 1886, she showed up on a cattle barge with a megaphone, shouting that it was, quote, a gigantic lie, a travesty, and a mockery, end quote, to portray liberty as a woman when actual American women had so few rights. After male critics branded Gage as satanic and a heretic, she became an expert on the subject of witch hunts. Her 1893 manifesto, Women, Church, and State, chronicled the 5 centuries between 1300 and 1800, when tens of thousands of human beings, mostly women, were accused of witchcraft and put to death by fire, hanging, torture, drowning, or stoning. In one gruesome scene, she described 400 women burning at once in a French public square for a crime which never existed, save in the imagination of those prosecutors, and which grew into their imagination from a false belief in woman's extraordinary wickedness. Gage died 2 years before the publication of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, a story that produced the most enduring image of female wickedness in American history. But Baum also introduced the world to a different kind of witch. It was the beautiful and benevolent Glinda, likely inspired by Matilda herself, who showed Dorothy that she always held the power to return home. Born March 24, 1826, Gage grew up as Matilda Joslyn north of Syracuse, New York, the only child of Helen Leslie and Hezekiah Joslyn, the town physician. The couple gave their daughter an unusual middle name, Electa, a Greek word that meant elected or chosen one. Hezekiah Joslin was a free thinker who taught his daughter the wisdom comes through one's experiences. Free thinkers of 17th century Europe challenged church authority, demanding the end of medieval witch hunts. Many of those backing the American Revolution also called themselves free thinkers, including Thomas Paine, whose 1776 pamphlet, Common Sense, helped instigate independence from England. Gage's parents were staunch abolitionists, whose home was a station on the Underground Railroad. Escaped enslaved people hid under the floorboards of the kitchen. Gage was homeschooled in Greek, mathematics, and physiology. At age 15, she set off for the Clinton Liberal Institute, a boarding school that promised an education free of religious dogma. At 18, she married Henry Gage, a merchant and store owner, and they settled in the Syracuse suburb of Fayetteville, where three of their four children were born in the 1840s. Their youngest daughter, Maud, arrived in 1861. Haunted by injustice, Gage only grew fiercer in her thinking. She was furious at an American failing to live up to the ideal of liberty for all expressed in the Declaration of Independence. She was unable to leave her children at home to travel 60 miles to the inaugural 1848 National Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York. But by 1852, when the third convention came to a city hall in Syracuse, she was ready to speak her mind to the crowd of 2,000. "There will be a long moral warfare before the citadel yields," Gage proclaimed. "In the meantime, let us take possession of the outpost. Fear not any attempt to frown down the revolution." Afterward, Gage found herself locked in a war of words with religious leaders. One local minister called the convention satanic, while another denounced the women as infidels. After the Civil War, the leaders of the movement formed the National Woman Suffrage Association, with Stanton as president, Anthony as secretary, and Gage as chair of the executive committee. On Election Day, 1872, Anthony was arrested and jailed for voting. Gage was by her friend's side for the trial in Rochester. The judge was a, quote, "small-brained, pale-faced, prim-looking man," end quote, Gage wrote. Quote, "With remarkable forethought, he had penned his decision before hearing," end quote, the case. The resulting publicity made Susan B. Anthony a household name. In 1876, a six-month celebration of the centennial of the Declaration of Independence attracted nearly 10 million Americans, roughly a quarter of the entire U.S. population, to Philadelphia. The activists petitioned President Grant to make a declaration of their own at the opening ceremony. The request was denied. That wouldn't stop the suffragists. At the ceremony, Anthony, Gage, and three other leaders lurked behind the press section. Gage clutched a 3-foot scroll and marched through the crowd of 150,000 people toward the podium. She passed the document to Anthony, who then placed it into the hands of the master of ceremonies, announcing, "We present to you this Declaration of the Rights of the Women Citizens of the United States." Before the guards could catch them, the suffragists quickly handed out printed copies of the Declaration to the reporters in the crowd. "The women of the United States, denied for 100 years the only means of self-government, the ballot, are political slaves with greater cause for discontent, rebellion, and revolution than the men of 1776. We ask justice, we ask equality, we ask that all the civil and political rights that belong to citizens of the United States be guaranteed to us and our daughters forever." Afterward, the women decided to record their struggles in a book, which eventually ballooned to comprise 6 volumes. The mammoth undertaking took a decade to finish. Most of the labor was split between Stanton and Gage, who completed The History of Woman's Suffrage, Volume 1, in 1881. The book's publication coincided with Maud Gage's freshman year at Cornell, the first Ivy League university to become coeducational. Maud resided in the female dormitory, Sage College, a magnificent brick building that still stands on the Ithaca, New York campus. One Saturday evening in February 1881, the young women of Sage were treated to a lecture by Maud's mother on the subject of women's suffrage. "A large audience greeted Mrs. Gage on Saturday evening," reported the Cornell Daily Sun. "Her discourse was well received." Still, Maud had a difficult time at school, left out of social clubs and mocked by college boys. Her name is Gage and she is lively, her schoolmate Jessie Mary Bolton wrote home in a letter. A girl scarcely dares look sideways here. I came to the conclusion long ago that Cornell is no place for lively girls. When Bolton co-founded a new chapter of Kappa Alpha Theta, the first sorority on an Ivy League campus, Maud was not on the membership rolls. Bolton also joined the Lawn Tennis Club for ladies, again without Maud. But fate would have its way. The 20-year-old student shared her room with a girl from Syracuse named Josie Baum, who introduced Maud to her cousin Frank, a 25-year-old bachelor, at a family party on Christmas Eve. At the time, Frank Baum was a failed chicken farmer who was writing and starring in his own touring stage plays. The two hit it off, and after a proper period of Victorian-era courtship, Baum proposed marriage. At first, Gage called her daughter a quote-unquote darned fool for wanting to drop out of college to marry this itinerant playwright and actor, a most disreputable profession. Yet a wedding date was set for November 1882. With a string quartet playing, the wedding took place at the Greek Revival home of the Gage family. The promises required of the bride were precisely the same as those required of the groom, noted a local newspaper in apparent surprise. At the time, it was standard for the bride, not the groom, to promise to love and obey. Now designated New York State commemorative landmark, owned and operated by the Matilda Joslyn Gage Foundation, the Gage House serves as a museum and dialogue center hosting programs on social justice led by progressive scholars and activists. One of its advisory board members, feminist icon Gloria Steinem, called Gage, quote, the woman who was ahead of women who were ahead of their time, end quote. After the September 1884 death of her gentle and solemn husband, Henry, an inspiration for the character of Uncle Henry in The Wizard of Oz, Gage threw herself even more fully into her work. Among other projects, she'd been collaborating with Anthony and Stanton on the first two volumes of The History of Woman Suffrage. In the mid-1880s, though, Anthony came into some money and took over the rights to the series to herself, paying Gage and Stanton for their shares. Meanwhile, Gage was increasingly frustrated by the more conservative leanings of her fellow suffragist leaders. Anthony, in particular, had strong ties with the temperance movement, which blamed alcohol for the bad behavior of men, but also had an overtly religious vision for national politics. Gage disapproved of the alliance between women's suffrage movement and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which began in 1874. In 1890, Gage left the National Woman Suffrage Association and founded the Woman's National Liberal Association, which fought for the separation of church and state and drew attention to the religious subjugation of women. As for the young Baums, Frank and Maud rented a house in Syracuse and had the first of their four sons. The new dad brought in steady money as the superintendent and sales manager for Baum's Castorine Company, a family business that created lubricants for buggies and machinery, a firm that still operates out of Rome, New York. Despite the outfit's success, Baum grew bored, yet he would never forget his days selling cans of oil, making the item a must-have for the Tin Woodman, who always needed a few drips to avoid rust. Gage corresponded regularly with her son and two other daughters, who had settled in the Dakota Territory, joining 500,000 other Easterners catching, quote-unquote, Western fever. As Baum heard about their lives, he yearned for a more adventurous one, relocating his family in 1888 to the new hub city of Aberdeen in what became South Dakota. He established a novelty shop on its main street called Baum's Bazaar. The store failed in just 15 months as Baum misjudged the clientele, focusing on frivolous toys and games and impractical items like parasols and fancy wicker. Frank had let his taste run riot, wrote sister-in-law Helen, who picked up the leftover inventory for $772.54, but turned her family's store, renamed Gage's Bazaar, into a success by selling things people actually needed. Around the time Baum closed the store in December 1889, Matilda Gage blew in from the east to visit. She stayed with the Baums every winter for the rest of her life. By early spring, Gage decided that she'd be remaining for the rest of the year. She and her band of suffragists convinced legislators to hold a referendum in the new state of South Dakota on the right to vote for women. Baum put his remaining cash into another distressed business, buying the weakest newspaper in a town that had several big ones. His first editorials for the Aberdeen Saturday Pioneer were high-minded. "The key to the success of our country is tolerance," he wrote. "The live and let live policy of the Americans has excited the admiration of the world." Volunteering as secretary of Aberdeen's Women's Suffrage Society, Baum argued that a law giving women the vote was more likely out there, as the West was new and open-minded. Gage barnstormed the state as Baum published editorials. "We are engaged in an equal struggle," Baum wrote. In the West, he added, "a woman delights in being useful. A young lady's highest ambition is to become a breadwinner." This inclusive spirit was often found in Baum's early editorials. But on November 4th, 1890, everything he advocated was shot down on the election. Baum had written a clever poem endorsing the town of Huron as the new state's capital. The voters chose Pierre. And at the end of the day, the male voters of South Dakota broke 2-1 against the right of women to vote. Aberdeen has also just faced a drought and massive crop failure that crushed its economy. Failing farmers and merchants were heading back east or on to other boom towns out west, leaving Baum with worthless credit slips and unpaid expenses. That drought was felt even more harshly 150 miles away at Standing Rock, the Sioux Reservation, where the community of several thousand began to suffer from starvation. As part of a well-documented propaganda campaign fueled by the U.S. military, Newswire reports warned that an uprising and massacre of the people of Aberdeen was coming. At first, Baum tried to keep his readers cool and sensible about this false and senseless scare. On November 29th, he wrote, "According to the popular rumor, the Indians were expected to drop in on us any day the last week. But as our scalps are still healthy condition, it's needless for us to remark that we are yet alive." Baum lambasted his rival newspapers for printing the worst of the propaganda and racism in order to sell newspapers. Probably papers who have so injured the state by their flashy headlines of Indian uprisings did not think of the results of such actions beyond the extra sale of a few copies of their sheets, Baum continued in his November 29th editorial. When U.S. officials ordered the arrest of Chief Sitting Bull in mid-December, newspapers all over the country reported that violence was likely to break out. Baum got caught up in the issue. "A man in the East can read the papers and light a cigar and say there is no danger," he wrote. "But put a man and his family on the east bank of the Missouri, opposite Sitting Bull's camp, he will draw a different picture." After police invaded Sitting Bull's camp on December 15th and shot him as he was trying to escape, wire reports went out far and wide, and Baum printed the headline on December 20th. "Expect an attack at any moment, Sitting Bull's death to be avenged by a massacre of whites in the near future." In the same issue, Baum printed his first of two racist editorials, dehumanizing the Native Americans as whining curs and miserable wretches. He called for the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians. On December 29th, as many as 300 Sioux men, women, and children, camping by a creek called Wounded Knee, were shot dead by U.S. soldiers. Baum's editorials put him on the wrong side of history. There's no known written record of Gage's response to this incident. She was living with the Baums at this time, so any exchanges she had with Frank would have happened face-to-face. But his editorials were certainly at odds with her own views. She had the utmost respect for indigenous communities. After paying several visits to an Iroquois confederation north of Syracuse, she concluded that the sexes there were nearly equal, and never was justice more perfect, never civilization higher. In 1893, she would become an honorary member of the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, and at the ceremony received the name of Ka-Ra-Ien-Ha-Wai, roughly translated as "She Who Holds the Sky." By January 1891, Baum seemed to have lost almost everything, including his integrity. His newspaper business collapsed. At the age of 34, he had no job, no career, no prospects, only a damaged reputation. That spring, the Baum family moved to Chicago, where Frank got a job working for the Evening City Post. In this new chapter of his life, he accompanied his mother-in-law to lectures, seances, and other gatherings. In September 1892, he became a member of the Theosophical Society. founded in New York City, the society was led by the Russian mystic Madame Helena Blavatsky. Matilda, a free thinker like her father, had joined the society at a conference in Rochester, New York, in March 1885. The brew of theosophical beliefs appealed to Gage. The ancient wisdom of Hinduism and Buddhism, combined with other mystical ideas like mediumship and telepathy, and all of which with an emphasis on universal human rights and living a life of nonviolence in both word and deed. A mission statement published by the group's founders in 1882 defined theosophy as a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, or color. Gage called theosophy the crown blessing of her life. Baum was especially interested in theosophy's description of the astral plane, a world of emotion and illusion where one's astral body could go for a supernatural experience reached through mental powers. An 1895 book called The Astral Plane, Its Scenery, Inhabitants, and Phenomena, would become so popular in the family that three copies would circulate among the Baum and Gage households. In 1893, Gage published Woman, Church, and State, her most influential work. Gage called it a book with a revolution in it. The 450-page volume put forth the provocative view that church and state had been suppressing women for centuries. The book was banned by her nemesis, Anthony Comstock, a U.S. postal inspector and the secretary of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, who called it salacious and declared he would bring criminal proceedings against any person who placed it in a public school or sent it through the U.S. mail. Gage cited passages from the King James Bible, such as, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," Exodus 22:18, showing the link between the preaching of religion and accusations of witchcraft. She traced this misogyny back to the Garden of Eden with the tale of Eve, a trickster serpent, and the forbidden fruit. A system of religion was adopted which taught the greater sinfulness of women, she asserted, and the persecution for witchcraft became chiefly directed against women. As this view gained traction within the church, Gage wrote, a witch was held to be a woman who had deliberately sold herself to the evil one. Anything could be used as evidence of witchcraft, possessing rare knowledge, having an unusual witch mark, suffering from mental illness, owning black cats, the use of herbs for healing, performing black magic, or having an ability to float or swim. But those condemned as sorcerers and witches, as heretics, were in reality the most advanced thinkers of the Christian ages, Gage wrote. She was especially moved by an 1883 gathering in Salem, Massachusetts, for descendants of Rebecca Nurse, one of the best-known women put to death in the Salem witch trials of 1692. Nurse was a 70-year-old woman with 8 children, and as Gage wrote, a church member of unsullied reputation and devout habit, but all those considerations did not prevent her accusation, and she was hung by the neck till she was dead. Gage was promoting her new book when she visited the 1893 Columbian Exposition, a spectacular World's Fair in Chicago. Her son-in-law was covering the sprawling event as a reporter, and he wrote about the light pouring through the walls of the windows of the white buildings, so bright that people purchased colored eye shades from vendors. The detail would later reappear in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, where all the residents of the Emerald City wear green eye shades. Because if you did not wear spectacles, the brightness and glory of the Emerald City would blind you, Baum would write in the novel. Indeed, the Oz novel's illustrations would be sketched by William Wallace Denslow, who was drawing splendorous images of the fair's fanciful architecture for another Chicago paper. One day, Gage visited the Exposition Women's Building and encountered statues immortalizing her old colleagues Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Seeing the statues only increased her ire at her old colleagues for aligning with the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also felt undervalued as a writer, and she harbored suspicions that Anthony had taken funds from a joint account to pay her own exorbitant travel expenses. "They have stabbed me in reputation, and Susan, at least, has stolen money from me," she wrote in a July 1893 letter to her son Thomas. "They are traitors, also, to woman's highest needs." Gage herself was falling into poverty. The cost of publishing and promoting her new book had exceeded its earnings, and she was now in debt. "I like an active life and one with freedom from money troubles," Gage wrote. "I like to be independent in every way, but fate or karma is against me." In February of 1895, Gage came across a writing contest in the children's magazine, The Youth's Companion, offering a prize of $500 for the best original story. The rich sum, equivalent to more than $18,000 today, seized her attention, and she considered her daughter Ellen and her son-in-law Frank the family's best writers. While there are no known records of her in-person conversations with Frank, she likely shared the same ideas she sent Helen in a letter. Keep in mind, it is not a children's paper, but a paper for youth and the older members of the family, she wrote. The moral tone and literary character of these stories must be exceptional. She encouraged them to write not narration or passages from history, but stories, which she defined as tales with a dramatic arc from the beginning to the end. Gage went so far as to suggest a topic. If you could get up a series of adventures or a Dakota Blizzard adventure where a heroic teacher saves children lives, or, she added, bring in a cyclone. Perhaps recalling a true twister story of a house rising off its foundations that Helen had written in the Syracuse Weekly Express in 1887. Above all, Gage added, create fiction which comes with a moral without, however, any attempt to sermonize. There's no evidence that Baum entered that particular contest, but around that time he began a new routine. He moved on to a new day job as a traveling salesman of fine china for Pitkin and Brooks. Every evening, especially when he was away at hotels, he'd write down ideas in a journal. Soon, Baum began submitting his tales and poems to newspapers and magazines. At first, Baum kept a track of his rejection letters in a journal called His Record of Failure, a title that could have described his whole business career, too. But in early 1896, Baum started receiving acceptance letters for his short stories. In January 1896, the Chicago Times-Herald published a story of his titled Who Called Perry? In February, the same paper published his story Yesterday at the Exposition, which imagined a World's Fair in Chicago nearly 200 years in the future. His first national magazine story was called The Extravagance of Dan and published in the National Magazine in May 1897. And that's where we're going to have to stop the article for today. We will finish it on our next program. Because we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.